It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Less than a year out now from the 2024 presidential election, newsrooms are in the preliminary stages of campaign coverage. There's decades of muscle memory that results in many outlets putting together the same old horse race style reporting as we lead up to and tick off primary after primary. However, Donald Trump, widely talked about as the presumptive Republican nominee for president, is an unprecedented candidate. The former president is currently facing 91 criminal charges across state and federal cases. And we also know, thanks to reporting from the Washington Post and others, that Trump and his associates have been developing alarming plans for a second term that would consolidate executive power, weaponize the Justice Department against his political opponents, and invoke the Insurrection Act to have the military respond to protests. Our next guest says not enough people know about these risks of a second Trump presidency and that the news media are dropping the ball when it comes to talking about them. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. How aware are you of Trump's plans for an actual second term? What have you been reading, hearing, or seeing from the news coverage about Trump's plans for retribution against his political opponents? What do you want to see the media do differently when it comes to covering Trump? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Margaret Sullivan is a Guardian U.S. columnist where she writes on media, politics, and culture. She was previously the Washington Post media columnist and the New York Times public editor. Margaret, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Well, before we get into specific recommendations for media, I just want to reflect a bit on that type of horse race coverage that we're familiar with. Reacting to a poll, making that kind of a story in itself. Why do you think that type of political coverage has been so persistent over the years?
You know, I think it's easy. That's part of it. It's very easy to do a story about a poll. You know, there's numbers. You can say they're neck and neck or this person's pulling ahead or not. It doesn't really require a lot of reporting. It doesn't require a lot of thought. And it's kind of knee-jerk. Now, I'm not saying that journalists are lazy, but it's a way to do an interesting story that doesn't really require any kind of, real reporting energy or much staff. So it's a very easy kind of thing to do. And it's the kind of thing we've been doing for a long time, so we know how to do it.
Yeah. Do you think it made perhaps more sense in a pre-Trump era, or did it always need a bit of refreshing?
It never was great journalism, but I think that in the pre-Trump era, you know, you basically had for many years, you know, two candidates, two different parties, two candidates who had different positions on things, but they were both kind of in the tradition of normal politics. But with Trump, especially as we head into this, what would be a second term, not a second consecutive term, but a second term for him, the kinds of plans that he's hatching really mean that the coverage needs to change. So that horse race coverage, you know, there's a place for it, but I don't think it should dominate the way it generally does.
And thanks to some reporting that's been done and from the Heritage Foundation's so-called Project 2025 documents, we do know something about the plans for a second Trump presidency should he be elected. Just to set the stage here, what are some of the things that you see the media not talking about enough when it comes to that?
So we know about these kinds of things because big news organizations like the New York Times or the Washington Post or ProPublica have done the stories. So it's not as if, you know, we're in the dark completely. But I think, you know, local news organizations and cable TV and network news are kind of ignoring these plans that are being made by Trump and his allies to do some really radical things in a second term. And you set it up beautifully in the introduction to weaponize the Justice Department, to, you know, invoke the Insurrection Act. So if people are protesting in the street, they could send the military out to go after political opponents in a very radical way. I mean, these are things that they continue to sort of chip away at the guardrails of our democracy and could really change the kind of America we live in. So that's so important that I think it should be dominating coverage. And, you know, we hear a lot about the same things all the time. So this is one of the things I think we should start hearing a lot about all the time.
And some of these things are in line with topics that President Trump has talked about before, going after his political opponents, cracking down on protesters. But it seems like here there's a more concerted, coordinated, documented effort going on. Is that part of the reason why this needs to rise to a higher level for the media?
Yeah, I do think it's at a different level. I think in Trump's first term, you know, he came in as an unusual candidate, but all these systems were set up that kind of tended to restrain what he could do. There were, you know, there were longtime public servants, not cronies, in positions. I mean, if you think back to the Georgia case in which then President Trump said to the Secretary of State, you know, we just need to find, you need to find me another 11,000 votes. That Secretary of State, who was a Republican, said, you know, essentially said, that's, I don't do that, and refused to do what Trump was asking him to do. But if there's an effort to put, you know, yes men and cronies in all these positions, you may not have a dutiful and conscientious public servant like that who will push back. And it really isn't about party. It's about how people get appointed.
We're talking with Margaret Sullivan right now, Guardian U.S. columnist, about how she thinks the media can do a better job of covering the dangers of a second Trump presidency. You can join in, too, with your questions, your comments. What do you want to see the media do differently when it comes to covering a Trump candidacy? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Margaret, when a news outlet does cover these topics, what are some of the ways you see them perhaps still falling short or missing the mark?
Well, I think that we go into this thing that, you know, sometimes is called false equivalency, or sometimes it's called both sides-ism, which means that we tend to play it safe, too safe sometimes, by equating things that aren't really equal. In other words, we say, in essence, this side of the situation says that it's raining outside, and this side of the situation says, no, it's not. Well, there actually is a truth there, and just having everybody say their thing and not trying to get to the truth of it is a dereliction of duty. So when we do that with politics, and we give everybody an equal say, even if one side is lying, even if one side is anti-democratic, you know, that's actually not how it should work. There's an expression that the famous Watergate journalist Carl Bernstein likes to say, and I think his former partner in crime, Bob Woodward, likes to say, which is get to the closest approximation to the truth that we can. And we don't really get there by equating unequal things. And that is a tendency that the media has because, I mean, for good reason, we want to be fair. We want to be seen as neutral. But sometimes it's not really fair to just go down the middle and equate things that aren't equal.
And in your recent column on this, you point out some of the language that is used in articles about Trump's plans for a second presidency. You use words like pussyfooting around and scaredy cat language. Do you think there's a level of fear, or fear of being seen as unfair, that kind of leads to some of this both sidesism that you're talking about?
I do. I mean, I experience it myself, you know, and I'm a columnist, so I get to express my opinion. But if people start saying to me, oh, you know, you're a partisan hack, or you're a lefty, or whatever it may be, I don't want to be seen that way. I want to be seen as a neutral, although opinionated, you know, impartial journalist. So you have, you know, imagine a whole news organization that needs to be seen as fair, and they're getting this criticism, which the right has become very, very skilled at being aggressive about. And so what's the tendency? Well, I'm going to, you know, kind of change the way I'm doing things. Maybe I'll move the whole thing over to the right. But the thing is, it never satisfies. It's set up not to satisfy. So I think the media gets to feeling on the defensive. Journalists get to feeling on the defensive. And the way they cope with it is by doing this kind of false equivalent journalism.
I want to give a listen to an example of a journalist that you say recently got it right when it comes to covering specifically election denialism. Here's a clip of George Stephanopoulos interviewing House Majority Leader Steve Scalise of Louisiana earlier this month on ABC's This Week.
Can you say unequivocally that the 2020 election was not stolen? What I've told you is there are states that didn't follow their laws. That is what the state constitution, the U.S. Constitution requires. I've seen in my own state where we had to send our elections commissioner to jail years ago for fraud and corruption, and we cleaned up our act in our state. Every state ought to follow the laws that are on their books. That's what the U.S. Constitution says.
That's not what I asked. I said, can you say unequivocally that the 2020 election was not stolen?
Look, Joe Biden's president. I know you and others want to talk about 2020. We're focused on the future. We've talked about 2020 a lot. We're talking about how to get our country back on track, how to get our economy moving, how to stand up to the bad actors around the world.
And that question got batted back and forth several times in that interview, eventually grounding things to a halt. Given that that can be the result of those interviews, what do you see as the purpose of coverage like that?
So I think that, Stephanopoulos did a good job in that he followed up. He was basically trying to get Steve Scalise to say, to say one way or the other, did he think the election was stolen or did he think the election was not stolen? We know that the election was not stolen. There's no reason to think that it was. And Steve Scalise knows that very well, too. I mean, he went so far as to say, look, Biden's the president. He was giving him that much. But he doesn't want to say the election wasn't stolen because there's a political price to pay for that. And the political price is that Trump would be mad at him. And, Trump has an iron grip on the party to the point where people won't say what they know to be true. So I think it's admirable to follow up like that and try to press for an answer. And if you can't get one, I mean, eventually he basically cut off the interview because he wasn't getting a straight answer. And I think I'd like to see more of that.
We're talking with Margaret Sullivan right now, columnist for The Guardian U.S. We're talking about how the news media have been covering the risks of a second Trump presidency and how they could do it better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see the media do different, if anything, in covering a Trump candidacy? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk with journalist Margaret Sullivan, now a columnist for Guardian US. She says the news media, national and local, aren't doing enough to warn people about Donald Trump's authoritarian plans for a second term were he to be elected president. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. And we can go to the phones now. We have Nels with us in Denton. Hi, Nels.
Hi. I had a question. She was talking about what can the media do in order to better prepare everybody for, a possible next Trump presidency or the dangers of that. My thoughts on that are just tell the truth. I mean, we went through the whole Russian collusion thing. That was all false. It's been proven as being false. The media jumped all over that. All of the major networks were talking about how they had irrefutable evidence that this happened, and it was all a lie. So why don't you just tell the truth? It may be that the majority of the people in America think that Trump would be the best president.
Gotcha, Nels. Thanks for the call. And Margaret, Nels saying that the media can get out ahead of itself a little bit. What do you think?
Well, I think that I actually have to disagree with Nels about the Russia coverage. While it's true that no collusion was proven, there's no question that Russia tried to interfere with the 2016 election. I mean, that's a fact. And, so I think this idea that that was all a hoax and the media is at fault is untrue. Yeah, they probably went a little crazy with the coverage, and I take the point on that. But, by saying just tell the truth, I think that good journalists do that, but there are a lot of choices that get made along the way. What do you emphasize? What goes in a headline? How do you cover something? How much emphasis do you give? And those are the kinds of, I guess, nuances that I'm talking about here.
Another thing I was curious about, Margaret, is the reach of a news story or a news outlet. Sometimes it can seem like the New York Times or whatever outlet you might choose has its baked-in audience. Are there new ways you would like to see newsrooms kind of reaching out to people that might not normally see their coverage?
So one of the things that I find very troubling is that local newspapers and local news in general is in trouble. And I'm so glad that, you know, we have you and other public radio stations like you to get the word out to people. But, you know, with local newspapers being so decimated, it's hard for people to absolutely know what's going on. And we're all kind of in our echo chambers. We're you know, many of us, some are watching this kind of thing. Some are watching that kind of thing. So I think that, you know, those news outlets that are very influential, I'd like to see them work more with local journalists and beef up local coverage as much as they can. I mean, there's so much attention paid to national politics. It would be great for them to divert some of that energy and some of that staff to helping local news outlets do, you know, do their job a little better. And there are also a lot of ways that local journalism can be boosted. For one thing, I think people need to pay much more attention to it and to support their local outlets. So that's really important.
And I'm curious, too, about the local TV news is one place where I know a lot of people get the majority of their news. And there's limited time in the format to cover something as in-depth as this. Sometimes you get a two and a half minute story about the latest political poll. How would you like to see those local outlets, especially TV, cover this kind of stuff?
Right. I think they ought to get their heads together and think about what their coverage is really going to be and to try to move away from that sort of simple horse race coverage. You can do a story about the actual effects of a presidency or the stakes of the election, the consequences. You can do it in a short amount of time, but you have to put some time and energy into thinking about what's our mission here. And our mission ought to be to really inform the public. So when they go to the voting booth, you know, they may not have the same opinion that you or I or someone else does, but they know what they're getting. And I think that's the key to this whole thing.
Now, it's possible that if news media effectively communicate these dangers and reaches all the people they want to, people still might choose Donald Trump. But you write in your recent column that when people understand the risks to their rights, they vote accordingly. Where do you look for evidence of that?
Well, I think we see it in your state and around the country with the restrictions of abortion rights. It turns out that people really didn't appreciate the way those rights were so precipitously removed. And there's been all kinds of, you know, referenda and laws and changes that have resulted from that, because people felt it as, hey, this is the government taking away my rights that have been well established. So I think, of course, abortion rights it's pretty easy to understand. You know, it's something that everybody can get their head around. I think this business of, you know, the sort of erosion of democracy is a little more subtle, but I still think that we can get it across to people. And when they understand it, I think they will probably be affected by it when they go to vote.
We've got time for, I think, one more call. JJ is with us in Two Rivers. Hi, JJ.
Hi. I was wondering why there's not stricter regulation from, like, the FCC on being dishonest on news programs. I mean, the reason we're in this position is because channels like Newsmax and One News and even Fox just blatantly and intentionally misinform their viewers. Wasn't the FCC have something, you know, to do about that? I mean, we spend so much time and effort bleeping bad words and blurring nipples. Why aren't we worried about the honesty and integrity of the coverage?
JJ, thanks for the call. Margaret, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I'm very reluctant. I mean, I share the feeling that I hate to see lies circulating in the media, but I'm also very reluctant to have the government controlling the press in any way. And I think one form of accountability that we are seeing is in the courts, because Dominion voting systems sued Fox News for defamation and ended up with a $787 million settlement. Fox basically had to admit that they lied to the public. And I think that that's probably a better and more promising avenue for some accountability. But it is, I agree, it's very frustrating to see the lack. We feel like there's nothing we can do about this, and it has such broad effects. But I'm not sure the answer is for the government to kind of crack down on it.
And Margaret, in just our last minute or so here, you're running a newsroom in 2024, hypothetically. What is your message to your reporters about how to cover the Trump candidacy?
So there's a press critic whose name is Jay Rosen, and he has coined a phrase, not the odds, but the stakes. So I would get across to my journalists, my reporters, what we want to cover here is not the horse race, the odds, but the stakes. What are the consequences if this person's elected? What are the consequences of if this person is elected? And most prominently, what are the consequences if Donald Trump is reelected? How is our country going to change? How are we going to get that across to people in a way that's fair and that's impartial but still is powerful?
We'll leave it there. Margaret, thanks for taking the time and talking with us today.
Thanks. It's a privilege. I appreciate it.
Margaret Sullivan is a columnist for The Guardian U.S. We talked with her about how the news media are covering the Donald Trump candidacy and his more authoritarian goals for a second term as president, and how the media can do it more effectively. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in today for Rob Ferret. Now, this year marks the 20th anniversary of the implementation of the Amber Alert program for missing children in Wisconsin. But in recent years, discussions have arisen about whether the criteria for the alerts might be too restrictive. We'll talk to an administrator for the National Amber Alert program about how effective the alerts are and what those criteria involve. But first, a Wisconsin senator is with us to talk about the possibility of changing the requirements for issuing an Amber Alert or introducing a new type of missing child alert. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you see an Amber Alert or a Silver Alert pop up on your phone or your TV, does it work for you? What's your reaction? Does it influence you to keep an eye out? Have you ever called in with a tip, or have you opted out of those alerts? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. State Senator LaTanya Johnson has represented the 6th Senate District in Milwaukee since 2017. Before that, she served in the State Assembly. Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the why, I'm curious about the what. As I understand it, this is not a proposal in a bill form yet, but what kind of ideas are you exploring when it comes to missing child alerts?
Well, what we're thinking about exploring is extending the silver alert. Right now, we have a silver alert for missing senior citizens, and we want to add a children's portion to that. It would be easier for us to add a system and use already existing infrastructure than it would be to create something totally new. And what we're thinking about is to provide services for children under the age of 17, children with mental illness, intellectual disabilities, a child with any type of disability that might prevent them from returning home safely, but also for children under 10 who we know aren't basically self-sufficient on their own. And it becomes critical to find those missing children.
And what has you thinking about these changes right now?
Well, Prince McCree, the 5-year-old that was found deceased, lived 5 houses from me. So I had the opportunity to be with the family when they were searching for Prince. The major frustration for this family was having him not qualify for an Amber Alert. I know that the Milwaukee Police Department tried on 2 different occasions to get an Amber Alert issued, and he didn't meet the criteria. And the reason he didn't meet the criteria was because they didn't have a suspect, either a description of a suspect or a suspect's vehicle, because the Amber Alert is for abducted children. Now, in the city of Milwaukee, we do have a critical missing child alert, but that is only goes out to broadcast, TV and radio. We had neighbors on our block found out that Prince was found deceased before they even knew that he was missing.
Now, the criminal complaint from the Milwaukee Police Department states that officers came to the home after Prince's mother called 911. They did discover blood and other signs of a murder, and this is a really heartbreaking case, but evidence points to the fact that Prince was killed in the home and his body was moved before his mother woke up and realized he was missing. And in that instance, an Amber Alert wouldn't have necessarily helped save his life. Do you still look to that as a reason to pursue changes?
Yes, because the reality is that there are going to be other children who come up missing. And so just seeing the frustration from Prince's family. Now, if Milwaukee Police Department requested an Amber Alert twice, they had been in that house. They saw the blood. They knew how urgent it was to find this child. And for them to request an Amber Alert and then to know that the child was either severely hurt or in imminent danger, and they still couldn't get one issued, it shows that the Amber Alert doesn't work for every child and every situation. So what we want to do, we want to bridge that gap between abducted children and children who are missing. And the reality is that very seldomly do people get to witness an abduction or even have a suspect available. We need to find something that will allow them to search for missing children in general. The Silver Alert does a 5-mile notification on people's cell phone. It pings. We need the cell phone notification because the reality is not everybody's around a television or a radio. Some people are at work. I live down the street from a firefighter who came home on the day that Prince was found deceased. He didn't even know that Prince was missing because he was at work. And so we want to make sure that everybody, especially in the case of a missing child, especially in the case of a missing 5-year-old, has that opportunity to return home safely. And right now, the Amber Alert doesn't qualify for every child.
Talking to State Senator LaTanya Johnson about changes she'd like to see to missing child alerts in Wisconsin. And Senator Johnson, are there other areas, other states that do something similar to what you're proposing, kind of adding on to the Silver Alert system?
Yes, Indiana is one of the states that has a modification to the Silver Alert. And we also have, I believe, Delaware. They also have modifications as well to the Silver Alert. So we have models to follow in other states. The thing that we have to do now is work with the Department of Justice, basically to make sure that when we do create this system, that we create it as much as possible, working as closely as possible with the Department of Justice, because we want it to work for them too, as well as work for the missing child. But I think to just say, you know, we have systems in place and no other system is needed, that's not true. That's not correct. Because if a 5-year-old didn't qualify for an alert system that would have alerted everybody, his neighbors, then who would? I'm really proud of my community. We had neighbors who put that, you know, Prince was missing on Ring and on Nextdoor. We had other members who put it, you know, on Facebook. But the reality is it still did not touch the magnitude of people that it needed to touch. And for the next child that goes missing, we want to bring them home safely.
Now, there are a lot more children that are reported as missing than do get Amber Alerts in a given year. And I know that Milwaukee, you know, has a lot of those. Prince's case aside, are there other cases that you've seen in your city that kind of like point to the need for this?
Well, not necessarily in the city, but the Lily Peterson case. An Amber Alert was requested for her too, and one wasn't issued because she did not meet the criteria. Since 2003, Wisconsin has seen 57 Amber Alerts from 2003 to May 2023. That shows you how few Amber Alerts get issued. And that's a problem, because clearly we have hundreds upon hundreds of kids that go missing in this state. And so it just shows that the bar is too high and we have a gap that a lot of children fall through the cracks.
And what is the timeline you're looking at in terms of getting some legislation drafted and circulating it for support?
We are hoping to have everything drafted by the end by the middle or the end of December. We are working on this legislation with lightning speed. Like I said, I do want the cooperation of the Department of Justice, but the reality is that we are going to introduce this legislation anyway, because as a legislature, standing there by Prince's family, seeing and hearing the police actually make those requests and be denied was unacceptable. It was unacceptable for Prince's family, and it'll be unacceptable for any other parent who has to go through that.
Well, Senator Johnson, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
State Senator LaTanya Johnson represents Wisconsin's 6th Senate District in Milwaukee. She was with us to talk about changes she's proposing to Wisconsin's missing child alert system. Coming up next, a national Amber Alert expert talks with us about how effective the alerts are and the reasoning behind the criteria for issuing alert. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should loosen the requirements for issuing some kind of alert for a missing child? Should we have a new type of alert, something built onto existing systems? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the Amber Alert System, potential changes, and how it works in Wisconsin and around the country. We're taking your calls, too, at 800-642-1234. Janelle Rasmussen joins us now, the National Amber Alert Program Administrator at the National Criminal Justice Training Center at Fox Valley Technical College. Janelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm curious to find out a bit more about how the system works. Someone notices their child is missing, they report it to local police. Where does that information go from there? Who decides whether an Amber Alert is going to be issued?
Sure. Well, the programs work a little bit differently in each of the states. So at the national level, we provide a recommended criteria and procedures for state to use. It's a federally recommended criteria. And from there, each of the states establish their own Amber Alert programs and put together criteria that is relevant to the work that they're doing in their individual states, the resources that they have available, and the types of cases that they have. The recommended criteria that we have is that a missing person is a child and that they're under the age of 18, that the police have reason to believe that the child has been abducted, that they have information to put out to the public that may be the child's information or it could be the suspect or vehicle information. And then we must have reason to believe that the child is in serious danger. And that information is important for us to make this Amber Alert happen.
And what's the reasoning behind some of those requirements, particularly having information about the suspect and the suspect's vehicle? Why are those in there?
Absolutely. Well, we know that when a child is abducted, that time is of the essence. In most cases, when a child is harmed, it's done within the first 3 hours of being abducted. So we want that information to get out very quickly to the public, and we want the public's help in locating that abducted child. And so the more information that we have and that we're able to put out to the public, the more likely that we're going to be able to recover that child. For the vehicle information, it's important if we're going to utilize the road signs that we have information on a vehicle to put up there. It doesn't always have to be the case. In some states, they do not require vehicle information in order to issue an Amber Alert. And same with the suspect information. It varies from state. Just some sort of information to put out on that child.
And the program is in its 20th year here in Wisconsin. What do we know about how effective Amber Alerts have been at locating missing children?
We know Amber Alert is very effective. To date, we've had 1,146 kids returned home just because an Amber Alert was issued, whether they were directly recovered because somebody saw that child, suspect, or vehicle and contacted law enforcement. They did so because an Amber Alert was issued and those kids are home or were recovered safely because of that alert. So it's very successful. But not just that, it's also a deterrent. We've had cases where a child has been abducted and that abductor is driving down the highway with that child in the car, gets an alert on their phone, sees it on the roadside, pulls over and drops off that child because they know that when an Amber Alert is issued, everybody is looking for that missing child.
And earlier we heard State Senator LaTanya Johnson talking about how she'd like to see some of the requirements for those alerts loosened up or having a missing child alert added onto our silver alert system. What do you think about those ideas of making it easier to issue an Amber Alert?
Yeah, I think that it's really important that Amber Alerts are reserved for cases that meet the criteria. We do not want to desensitize the system by sending out hundreds of alerts or sending them out too frequently when we have cases that don't meet that criteria. And a lot of people describe it as the car alarm syndrome, where you walk by and a car alarm is going off and you don't pay attention. We want people to know that when an Amber Alert is issued, this is exactly what we're looking for and we need your assistance. But it is critical that we have systems in place that are used for other types of cases. So if there is a child that is missing, and we can't confirm it's been a child abduction, but we do know that that child is still missing, and based on their age, they may be in danger, we want to have a system available for them. So we encourage states to have a secondary system called an endangered missing person alert, where they can send out alerts to the media and ask for their help in broadcasting that information to look for that missing child, that missing adult, or somebody who may be missing and in need of medical attention. So we do encourage states to have a secondary system in place and send out that information because any child who is missing is endangered.
We have time for one quick call. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm 69 years old, and I don't have any children. And I can see how the Amber Alert can be helpful. But I think when you really boil it down, I read articles after the fact in the newspaper, how it's usually irresponsible parents. And I really think these people should pay for the Amber Alert system if it's been used.
Mike, thanks for the call. Sorry we don't have a lot of time. Janelle, again, these are alerts that are issued when the standard is pretty high in our last 30 seconds or so. Oh, Janelle, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. And just a reminder that the standards are pretty high for an Amber Alert being issued, correct?
Absolutely. The criteria is very strict, and we do, you know, encourage the states to establish their own criteria because it needs to be what works best within the states. But we certainly create an opportunity for this criteria to go across the border. I think it's important to remember that when a child is abducted too, you can go from Wisconsin into Minnesota pretty quickly. And if there is a case like that, Wisconsin can reach out to their border states and they can request an Amber Alert in that border state. But the criteria has to be pretty similar, and it is across the state lines so that you can make that request if an abducted child does travel into another state.
Well, Janelle, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Janelle Rasmussen is the National Amber Alert Program Administrator at the National Criminal Justice Training Center at Fox Valley Technical College. She talked with us about how Amber Alerts work in Wisconsin and what options are out there for missing child cases that don't necessarily meet the Amber Alert criteria. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an excerpt from the podcast Humanity Unlocked, which focuses on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin.
Tattoos can tell the story of a person's life. They feature aesthetic beauty, inside jokes, or family memories. Some of Daniel Schleicher's tattoos memorialize his favorite people. His story comes to us from the Odyssey Beyond Bars project, which provides classes for students incarcerated in Wisconsin.
I'm a little nervous, I ain't gonna lie to y'all, but bear with me. All right, so my story's called Penguins, Bears, and Tattoos, Oh My. When I was a kid, I looked up to Kenny. I wished he was my dad. He wasn't. Kenny was, in fact, my two older sisters' dad. I remember him coming over to our house to pick up my sisters for his weekend to have them. I never understood why I couldn't go with them. It was clear I was a likable kid, how he played basketball with me while waiting for them to get ready, which felt like forever, yet it was probably just minutes. In those moments of shooting hoops, I would even pretend he was my dad, but Kenny wasn't my dad. He wasn't my stepdad. He was, however, a father figure, and I honor him today in calling him my bonus dad. I only wish I could have told him this, for those moments spent with him meant a lot to me. You see, Kenny passed away in 1994, and what he doesn't know is he played such an important part of my life and had a role in my love for tattoos. He had several himself, and the only one I remember was a tattoo of a penguin on his hand. So to a boy looking up to this man, I just thought this was what men do, is get tattoos. I got my first tattoo at the age of 13 in a friend's garage. It was a nickname friends called me back then, and it was difficult to hide from my mother. And now that I'm older, several tattoos later, it's still getting difficult to hide them from my mother. I never had a scheme to my madness of tattoos other than if I wanted something somewhere, I got it. I'm tattooed literally head to toe. I can't say I have a favorite. I have some I want to cover and many more I want to get. I do, however, have some that got me through some dark times with just a glance, like my children's names on my fingers that I see every moment of the day. There's my mother's name on my arm, as she's been the strength and my unconditional love. I have my granddaughter's handprint over my heart because she's a piece of my heart in human form. And I have my last name, Schleicher, which is Kenny's last name, that I carry on for him. I also have a rose tattoo for him with Rest in Peace Kenneth and the date he passed. And yet my mind comes back to that penguin tattoo. That tattoo created a love for penguins that runs so deep. I customized my own penguin stuffed animals for my kids and granddaughter when I was in Columbia Correctional Institute. I used to work for the Incel Teddy Bear Project, and that's where I had the opportunity to do so. I've drawn cards and pictures of penguins for them. And when I did beadwork, I made those tiny penguins that fit on the tops of pens, and their little arms would flop all upside down with each pen stroke. That's not where my love stops. I had penguins looked up to discover that they only mate once in their lifetime, and on an occasion, if the mate dies, they will move on. The male even goes as far to find a pebble or a rock, like a diamond, that he kicks around until he presents it to the female. If that is not a true love story for you, then I don't know what is. I decided I'd like to get a penguin tattoo in memory of Kenny. I wanted the exact tattoo or close to, so I wrote home asking for photos of these in order to draw it. That's when I discovered my whole life was a lie, that Kenny did not have a penguin tattoo on his hand like I remembered. He had, in fact, a bear tattoo, and not just any bear, but the Ham's Bear from Ham's Beer. Okay, in all fairness, this was over 30 years ago, and I only had minutes with the man, and the ink back then was not a good quality. So this tattoo was mistaken as a penguin. You can see it. Yeah. Now you know how I feel. Now I have to get this Ham's Bear tattoo in memory of Kenneth Schleicher. And I still want to get a penguin tattooed for the moments he shared and what that meant to a boy just wanting a father. Something I never got to tell him. Thank you.
That story about tattoos came from Daniel Schleicher while he was incarcerated in Oregon, Wisconsin. His story is featured in the newest season of the human-powered podcast, Humanity Unlocked, which is focusing on people impacted by the justice system in Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Packers legend and Lambeau Leap inventor Leroy Butler joins the show. He'll talk about his career and answer some questions about the Packers submitted by 8th graders. That's tomorrow morning after 7 on The Morning Show. How many people do you know? It might take a while to count them out, but researchers at the University of Washington have arrived at an estimate. The average person knows 611 people. Now, someone you know, by their measure, is someone you recognize by sight, know how to contact, and have had some kind of interaction with in the last 2 years. They reach their number by starting small. For example, asking people how many Marias they knew or how many construction workers. Knowing what percentage of Marias make up the U.S. population then helped extrapolate someone's overall acquaintances. Those numbers aren't perfect. Look, I like to socialize, but frankly, 611 people sounds like a lot to handle. Fortunately, the response for how many close friends we have is more manageable, about 2 to 3. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.